It can be a depressing thing or discouraging thing sometimes to look up statistics about the state of the home within our culture. There's a number that sometimes makes the rounds, or has at least in the last few months or years, that people look at and they say that's a positive sign. That's a good thing, because depending on how you word it or how you look at statistics, things like the raw rate or the raw number or the trend or whatever word you want to use for the number of divorces in our culture has actually decreased in recent years. That's a good thing until you dig into the data. And you figure out, well, while that sounds like a good number, a major reason that's the case is how many people in our culture are living together without being married. And so when they separate, it's not a divorce. So what really we've done in our culture overall is basically traded one problem for another. God's people are not just trying to be a little better than the culture. Because see, sometimes those things we see in the culture around us kind of bleed into our thinking, the way we look at things, and we sometimes think, well, we're not as bad as that, or we're not following that, so we must be better. Our goal is never to be just a little bit better than the culture. Our goal is never just to be okay. Our goal as Christians is always to shine the glory of God in everything that we do. To follow what God would have to say, to follow His standard perfectly, as best we possibly can, as feebly as we're going to, but as best we can in every area, every arena of life. And that includes in the home. Our scripturing this morning came from Genesis chapter 2, and it was a curveball, because we're not going to study Genesis chapter 2. Bruce read the right passage. That's what I had in the bulletin. That's what I wanted read. But I want us to read that passage more to introduce the lesson, because it's in Genesis chapter 2 where you have that standard that's given for marriage, where God, as it sometimes said, performs the first wedding ceremony. He brings the man and the woman together, and you have the standard given near the end of that passage of what marriage was meant to be all the way back from the Garden of Eden. It's supposed to be one man and one woman for life in a committed, exclusive relationship. That's it. And you read through the Bible, that's it. That's God's standard all the way through. And you think, wait a minute, I know guys in the Old Testament, like, you know, tons of wives and everything, but remember when Jesus was asked about that, He said that's not the way it was supposed to be. From the beginning, it was not so. It was supposed to be one man, one woman for life in a committed, exclusive relationship. That's it. And as long as the world stands, that's going to be God's standard. That's what we must always strive to have. There's another passage that I want you to turn to this morning that takes that same concept and beautifully illustrates it for us on this side of the cross and gives for us the foundation of what marriage is supposed to be. I want you to turn to Ephesians chapter 5. And while you're turning to Ephesians chapter 5, let me remind you sort of how the book of Ephesians unfolds, because the opening three chapters of the book of Ephesians is more the doctrinal stuff. There's some deep stuff in those first three chapters, but a lot of it centers around the fact that the church belongs to Jesus. This is the book where you talk about Christ being the head of the body and those sorts of things. At the end of Ephesians chapter 1, you'll talk about Jews and Gentiles coming together in Ephesians chapter 2, and a lot of very deep things. But then when you turn to Ephesians chapter 4, Paul, having laid down all of this doctrinal stuff, begins to lay out sort of the practical side of things. Now that you know these things about how deep and important this is, then how is this supposed to live itself out in your everyday walk? And when he gets to Ephesians, what we know is Ephesians chapter 5, beginning of verse 22, and going all the way into chapter 6, he's going to write about the household. He's going to spend some time writing about wives. He's going to talk about husbands. When you cross into the chapter 6, he's going to talk to children. He's going to talk to fathers specifically. And then even in that first century setting, he's even going to talk to servants or slaves and masters within the household. But from Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, all the way to the end of the chapter, he speaks specifically to husbands and wives, to that marriage relationship. But I want you to notice near the end of that discussion, in verse 32, he makes a very profound statement. When he says, "This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it," the husband-wife relationship, the marriage, "refers to Christ and the church." Sometime, just spend some time with that concept. In other words, just let that thought wash over you for a moment. That everything Paul says for these 11 or 12 verses, from verse 22 through the end of the chapter, between husbands and wives, is meant to be a picture of Christ and the church. And that's why we say this is the foundation for marriage for those of us on the other side of the cross. Because if we understand this relationship as best we can of Jesus and His bride, Jesus and the church, then it makes the rest of this passage just fall into place. And I want us to consider this passage this morning to help us as we think about our homes, our marriages. And if you're not married yet, think, file this away because this is what you're shooting for, aiming for in the future. Under three observations. One for the wife, one for the husband, and one for the couple. Each one of which is to have a goal, all found in this same passage. The wife's goal is submission like the church. And you're going, all right, yep, a man's preaching. We don't like that word. We don't like the concept. But you read this passage, especially beginning before this passage, you're going all the way through the end, it just runs through it that this is part of it. In fact, in Ephesians 5, verse 21, Paul had talked to all Christians that they were to be submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. But then he gets to specifically wives, and he gives that that is their goal in marriage. That's what they are striving to do if they're going to picture this relationship of Christ and the church. We're going to dive a little deeply for a moment. Because I want us to think about the precept he gives and also the picture he gives. When we get to the precept, we're going to dive a little deeper than we usually do in a sermon, but I want you to see why. First of all, think about the precept itself. It's interesting that the word submit in verse 22 in the original language is not there. And you're going, wives are going, we're off the hook. No, you're not. Because in verse 21, he had just said all Christians are to be submitting to one another. And then as he begins to talk about the home, the first example of that he gives is the wife. So as all Christians are submitting to one another, one specific arena of that is the wife submitting to her husband. That's how intricately related it is to that concept. The word submit or submitting comes from a word that literally means to arrange under. You may have heard it said before. It was originally a military term because all the people in the military are equal in value. They're all human beings. They're all going for the same goal. But those who are not in the Roman world, a centurion or something, arrange themselves under the leadership of that leader of their battalion or whatever it happened to be. That's the same concept that Paul brings forward here to the home. And the wife arranges herself under the leadership of, the headship of the husband. Now here's where we're going to go a little deeper. Because I want us to think about that singular word and how powerful it really is. When Paul uses that word submit or submitting, three facts about it. One is it's a word in the present tense. In other words, this is continual action. This is something a wife must continually be doing. In the same way, remember verse 21, as all Christians are to be submitting to one another. How strange would it be if Paul had written just a verse earlier, Christians, submit to one another once, and then you're good forever. That didn't make sense. Or Christians, be submitting to one another just when you kind of feel like it. It doesn't make sense. But he uses a present tense term for all Christians to say, this is what we are to be doing, and then brings that forward to wives and say, this is something you are to continually be doing. And he also writes in what's known as the middle voice, which means this is a voluntary action. This is a choice. No one can make a woman, a wife, do this. By the way, husbands, that means we can't force her to either. It is up to her to voluntarily choose to arrange herself under, in a continual sense, the leadership, the headship of the husband. And then when you think about that word, it's also a participle, which means it helps to obey or helps to fulfill the main verb of the sentence. And if some of these guys in here know Greek, know Paul wrote some really, really, really long sentences sometimes, like 10, 12 verses sometimes. Every English teacher would have failed him in a heartbeat, okay? The main command in this whole section is actually found all the way back up in verse 18. Be filled with the Spirit. Be filled with the Spirit. In the same way that Christians submitting to one another, verse 21, shows that they are Spirit-filled people, then a wife choosing to voluntarily arrange herself under the headship of the husband is a sign of or proof of that she is a Spirit-filled woman. That's how deep this command actually goes. And you think, well, that's impossible. That's why Paul then gives the picture when he writes, as to the Lord. And then he illustrates that in verses 23 and 24 with this picture of the church submitting to Christ in all things. I want you to think about something for a moment. Just step out of the realm of marriage for a moment. If we this morning got on Facebook and well, hopefully not this morning because you're in church. If it's afternoon, you got on Facebook and you saw that some congregation that you'd heard of somewhere, that the elders had got up that morning and made an announcement that said, you know what, we've been thinking about this whole instrumental music thing and it's not that big of a deal. And so next Sunday, if you'd like to play the piano in worship service, it's fine. Or if you'd like to join our band next week, that's fine. We would go ballistic. We would absolutely lose our minds. How could they possibly do such a thing? Why? Because they're not submitting to the headship of Jesus. They're being so arrogant as to say, I get to choose what I want to do. And it doesn't matter what Jesus says, we're going to do it. We would rightfully go crazy about something like that. Then why, when a wife goes to her girlfriends and says, he didn't want me to do this, but I thought it'd be fun, so I did it anyway, they go, you go, girl. When it's the exact same command. We cannot go ballistic when a church decides to be arrogant and change and not be submissive, and then be encouraging of a woman who does the same thing to her husband. And here's what often happens. When you preach about this, what often happens is that, yeah, what about? Oh, that's going to be in the balance of this passage. That's going to be taken care of in a moment. But if our first reaction is the yeah, what abouts, we've got a problem. Because the point that Paul is trying to lay out here, remember, is the picture of Christ and the church. The perfect picture. The perfect illustration. And our thinking has to be, that's what I'm striving for. It is not then that the husband is some tyrannical jerk and gets to do whatever he wants to do. But a wife must make certain that she chooses to voluntarily arrange herself under his headship continually, as a spirit-filled woman, submitting ultimately to Jesus. And to balance that, he gives the husband a goal that he is to sacrifice like the Christ. Husbands, if we think that, well, okay, now he's told the wives what to do, so I'm going to make up all the rules, I'm going to do everything, so everything feeds me, my ego, then you've totally missed the rest of this passage. And you've missed the balance of, and by the way, you're a creep, sorry, and by the way, your soul's in danger. Because you've missed exactly what Paul tells husbands to do. When he also gives, guess what, a precept and a picture. He does the same thing for the husbands. And by the way, he only takes 3 verses to teach women. Guys, we need 9. Read into that whatever you want. But he gives us 9 verses in a precept and a picture. The precept is to love your wives. The word love there is that a form of that word agape. You heard it quoted many times in sermons, or mentioned many times in sermons probably. That word agape is the one that's described in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Love is patient and kind and all those things found there. It's the word that we sometimes say is self-sacrificial. That's why this point is sacrifice like the Christ. It's the kind of love that seeks the best for the recipient of that love. It seeks the ultimate good for the recipient. That's the precept. That we are to love our wives in that agape fashion. Well, think about that term as well. It is also in the present tense. Just as the wife must continually make the decision to submit herself to the husband, so the husband must continually make the decision to be that self-sacrificial one who loves his wife. That is a continual, ongoing, not just day by day, but moment by moment decision he must make. This word is also in the active voice. And you say, well, obviously it's love, but think about what that means. What that means is it is an action that has a result on the recipient of the action. Boy, that goes against how we often define love in our culture, doesn't it? Because what we often think of as love is, I'll kind of love them so I get something from it. That's not what this word means. This word means I love someone so that they receive something. So there's a benefit or a blessing in their life. The action has something for the recipient of the action. And it's also an imperative. There is no way around the fact this is a command. Paul is not using a word that says this is a good suggestion for your home. He's not giving this and saying, I sure hope this is something that happens. He's saying, husbands, this is absolutely commanded that you love, you agape, you self-sacrifice yourself for her. And you go, man, that's hard. Yeah, but he also gives a picture. And guys, it's really, really tough. As Christ loved, agape'd the church and gave himself for her. There is no higher bar. None. There is no higher bar to reach for than the picture that Christ gives through the pen of Paul for husbands. You love, you sacrifice for her in just the same way as Jesus did for his body, the church. You think about that, and considering this is supposed to be a Christian marriage, it's going to be the picture of Christ in the church. We'll get to that again in just a moment. What is the highest good, the ultimate good, that a husband could do for his wife? I make a lot of money. She lives in a fine house, and we drive fine cars, and there's no dress anywhere that I can't afford for her. This is not our life, by the way. We do live in a fine house, but there are dresses I can't afford. No, that's not it. She feels safe in our home. I provide for her. We have a lot of things. We've got a security system or whatever. And so those things are fine. Those things are good. Husbands, that's not the ultimate good. The ultimate good is you get her to heaven. Amen? You do nothing that would keep her out of heaven. You be the reason. You be the reason why your family's here on Sunday night. Don't make her come by herself. You be the reason why, even in a crowded restaurant with waitresses going, "What are you going to drink?" or whatever, you say, "I'm sorry, our family's going to pray." Because that's what this family does. The ultimate good is not how much money you make or how safe she is or how connected she is. The ultimate good is you are doing every last thing within yourself to say, when I die, I've done everything to help her reach the gates of heaven. That's it. That's it. There is no higher standard. And by the way, this means that sometimes you may not get what you want. Folks, Jesus is the head of the church, and he didn't get everything he wanted. You think about him in the Garden of Gethsemane. Did he want to go to the cross? No. He prayed that this cup, this wrath of God, would be taken away from him. Now, he coupled that with, "Your will, not mine, be done." But what was in his heart right then? "I don't want to do this. I don't want to go through that cup, that wrath. That, so I don't want to do that." But for the benefit of his bride, the church, he did it. There are going to be times, husbands, where we do things that we profoundly do not want to do, that are profoundly not easy. But we do them for the spiritual benefit of our wife. Not just so we have more money, not just so we feel safer, but so that she has no barrier because of us into getting to heaven. That's our goal. And husbands, if that's not what we're doing, notice I said we're doing, we need to apologize to her, repent, and start doing it. Because that's our goal. There's about a 1,000-year-old Viking legend, and I'm going to mispronounce the names because they're Vikings. They don't name their people like Tom and Bill and stuff. They're mean over there. There's a 1,000-year-old Viking legend of a guy named Orm Sturluson. I bet you never thought you'd hear that name mentioned in a sermon. That says that he picked up the mast of a ship and carried it on his back for 3 steps 1,000 years ago. By the way, the legend also ends with him breaking his back because he did it, but that's not the fun part of the story. But because the legend contained that detail, people wondered for centuries if anybody could actually match that legend. Now, I tried. No, I'm just kidding. But for years, people thought, is this even safe to attempt? Well, yeah. Because a few years ago, a name of Hofner Borjensen, of course, because he's from Norway, decided to give it a try. A 30-foot log that weighed 1,433 pounds was placed on a machine. He got under it and took not 3 steps, but 5. By the way, because it's a Viking legend, he did it in sub-zero temperatures. What a man. Here's the thing. Most people would say something like that is the greatest feat of strength any man could ever possibly attain to. That's child's play compared to leading a family to heaven. Wives, the weight your husband feels on his shoulders to help you and your children get to heaven, you can't imagine. And husbands, if you're carrying that weight, God bless you. God bless you. Because you're carrying the greatest weight this world will ever know, of striving to not be a barrier at all to her entering the gates of heaven. The wife's goal, submit like the church. The husband's goal, sacrifice like the Christ. When you put them together, you have the couple's goal, and that's to be a sketch of the connection. That's when you get back to verse 32. When Paul gets to his point, he says, this mystery is profound, and I'm saying it refers to Christ and the church. And so some people might say, well, good, because this looked really hard from verse 22 to about verse 31, this whole submission thing, I don't like it, or I'm not sure as a guy I really want to carry that kind of weight. So thank you, Paul. You've let us off the hook, because what you've actually been talking about here is Christ and the church. And okay, good, I can deal with that. I can preach sermons about that. I can hold the elders accountable for that. I can try to be a faithful Christian for that. But then he turns right back around in verse 33 and reiterates exactly what he'd been saying for all the previous verses, just in case we think we can get off the hook. See that a husband love his wife. It's the word agape there again. And see that the wife respect, honor, show deference to, phobao is the word, her husband. So if I think because he wrote in verse 32, I'm off the hook. No, I'm not. What he is trying to say is that when you look at the relationship between Jesus and the church, that when a husband and a wife are striving to be all that they can be for him, it becomes a sketch of that perfect relationship between Jesus and the church. Lee and I one time read a book where the person illustrated it this way. He said, when you think about this connection, you think about the vertical relationship between Jesus and his church. And he said, what marriage is taking that vertical relationship and bending it outward to the world. Reflecting it out, where people can look at a couple and say, that's what the church and Christ is supposed to look like. Yes. And it works both ways. In every way that the church submits to Christ, the wife should submit to her husband. In every way that Christ is the perfect, loving, sacrificial head of the church, that's what the husband should be for the wife. It's a sketch of this beautiful connection. And some people are going, well, that's a high bar. That seems very impossible. How do you possibly do that? Very quickly, I know I'm running out of time. Let me give five suggestions. I just have a comment or two on each one. Because there are people in here who've been married 50, 60 years, 70 years, and they're going, we've got this, but admittedly, I go, there's still some things to work on. There are others who have been married just a few years, they think there's been some rocky patches, we're in okay, but we need to do better. There are others who are frankly thinking right now, I sure wish the one sitting next to me or the one who's still at home would get this right. Because we need to be spiritually connected. We need to make sure that we're not just having fun together, we're not just making memories together, but that we go to heaven together. How do we do this? Five suggestions very quickly. Number one, it takes devotion to God first. I cannot know what it is like to have the relationship of Christ and the church if I'm not following God to know what that relationship is supposed to look like. You've seen the picture before of the triangle where the husband's in this corner, the wife's in this corner, and God's at the top. As they move closer to God, they're automatically moving close together. It must be where there's a devotion to God above everything else. Everything, including your spouse, by the way. God has to come first for there to truly be that strong, intimate relationship. Number two, it takes dedication to your vows. When you stood before a preacher or a judge or whoever it was that married you and performed the ceremony, he probably read some kind of vows, or maybe you wrote your own. But somewhere in there, you basically said you were going to do this stuff. Did you mean it or not? Or you just mouth some words so you get to the ceremony and get to the honeymoon? Did you mean it or did you not? Three, it takes decisions that are ongoing. Every moment of every day, this is who we are going to be. I'm going to be. Am I going to fail? Yes, I'm human. Is your spouse going to fail? Yes, they're human. But there are going to be decisions made constantly. This is who we are going to be. That's the goal of every moment of every day for that couple. Four, it takes distance from the world's thinking. Well, I know couples in the world who aren't doing very good and we're better than they are. It's not about being better than anybody else. It's not about letting the world's thinking of what success in marriage looks like infiltrate our thinking. By the way, if you're having difficulties in your marriage, one of the very best things, I'm being serious, one of the very best things you can do is get off social media for about a month. Because what you see on there so often are these just little subtle jabs at marriage. How dumb husbands are, how dumb wives are, how stupid marriage is, how silly. You don't need to hear that when your marriage is struggling. You need to spend time in the Word of God to see how beautiful marriage actually is. And you need to be seeking out people who will help you be connected back to those vows that you made and the God you're supposed to be serving. And if you're failing in that, number five, it takes defection from being unfaithful. When you haven't made the decisions, when God isn't really first, it takes saying, that's the path we're leaving and this is the path we're going. Honey, I'm sorry. I love you and we're going to do better. It's a lot easier to preach than it is to do. But it's a beautiful, beautiful thing when it's lived out between two people for a lifetime. A mystery deep, a bond divine, two made one by heaven's design. She yields in grace, he leads in love, a portrait drawn from God above. He lays his life as Christ the head, with strength that serves and arms outspread. She honors him with trust, with heart sincere, reflecting trust, not ruled by fear. He helps her with the holy word, his voice of truth so gently heard. She blossoms there beneath his care, adorned in love beyond compare. Not master's hand nor servant's chain, but covenant where both remain. Where love and reverence intertwine, a sacred dance by grand design. For as the church to Christ is bound, so in their vows true joy is found. Not self, but sacrifice defines the love that deepens over time. O vast mystery, yet lived each day, two hearts that choose the narrow way, a union shaped by Christ the Lord, a witness to the living Word. This mystery is profound. It refers to Christ and the church. I know a sermon like this one doesn't hit everybody the same way. I get that. But we have to preach and teach on the Christian home, because that is the ultimate unit God created first. It is the foundation for every other unit He would ever create. We have families who struggle. But aren't you thankful we have families that are trying to do what's right? They go through rocky patches, but they're trying. In just a moment, as we extend the invitation, I'll mention this again. I won't mention this every week, but I want to every once in a while to remind you that the last few weeks we've had the elders and whoever's preaching up here, but also one of the elders goes to the back. I want to mention that again because I know you preach about something like marriage. You may not want to come forward and say our marriage is in trouble or I'm worried about my spouse or something like that, but you may want to talk to one of the elders or elders and wife and pray with them privately. We would highly recommend that. But maybe you do want to come forward and say, we're struggling, I'm struggling. Maybe it's marriage or something else, but I want the church to rally around us because we want to get this right. Or maybe you've never entered that relationship of Christ and the church. That's where a godly marriage begins, is when both people, both hearts, are striving to be all that God would have them to be in covenant relationship with Him first and then with one another. And maybe this morning you need to be immersed, baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to enter that relationship and then walk with Him each day, come what may. Whatever your need is, will you come? Always stand and sing to encourage you.